This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anisha Rao. Everyone has a different idea about what may be too risque for them to watch or listen to, especially around children. For years, production companies, music labels, and now podcast streaming services have encouraged artists to warn audiences when their work contains profanity, detailed conversations about sex and sexuality, and graphic violence. But there have never been hard and fast regulations about what makes artistic work explicit. Artists have pushed back on explicit content labels for as long as they've been issued, especially when it comes to work that includes frank conversations about sex and sexuality. Chloe Crabtree is a cultural historian and the creator of the public research project Sourced. She's with me now. Chloe, welcome to The State of Things.
Hi.
So I love the story behind the creation of the parental advisory label, and I wonder if we could start there. Tell us that story and how that label came to be.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of came out of a period where the United States was sort of facing this satanic panic. Everyone was worried that the moral fabric of, America's youth was fracturing and kids were going to get corrupted by rock and roll. And, you know, it's a story that has been going on between America's parents and their children for centuries, really. But what happened was, Tipper Gore, who is the wife or former wife of Al Gore, she came across her daughter singing lyrics to a Prince song that had reference to female masturbation, was so scandalized by it, got together with some of her friends who are also, they were also their own lobbyists on their own, but they were, you know, wives of prominent political figures. And the end result was they created the PMRC, which is the Parents Music Resource Center. And they were able to get a congressional hearing to discuss how they could change, you know, how people accessed explicit music.
And what were they trying to get out of this hearing? Did they want government oversight over the record industry, or what was their end goal here?
It's interesting because if you listen to interviews with Tipper Gore throughout the period, she constantly says she doesn't want to censor music. She doesn't want to take people's favorite songs away. She's just trying to regulate the free marketplace, essentially. She wants to give parents a choice to choose what kind of music their children listen to according to their taste. What I think is really interesting is that the majority of the music she is focusing on, it does have to deal with women's sexuality. She claims there's music that has to do with violence or violent sex acts. But if you look at the list of songs that the PMRC released, they call them, I think it's Dirty 15 or something like that. But it's
Filthy
15 songs.
I think, yeah.
15, yeah. And there's 15 songs there that they deemed so, you know, horrendous for children to hear that they needed to have an advisory label on them.
So I know there was a little bit of a back and forth between the record industry and this commission kind of discussing what kind of coding system are we going to create? Are we going to look like movies where there's this rating code, or is it going to look a little bit different? What eventually led to the decision that RIAA decided to kind of create this label, this obscene label?
Well, I mean, the congressional hearing from the outset was never meant to create any kind of legislation. What you have, which is different with films and TV, is that there are actual legal requirements for broadcast. So, you know, times that you see nudity or, you know, certain number of explicit words being used, like that has all been regulated through the MPAA and the FCC. But with music, it's a little bit different because there's poetic license there. You have people who are speaking, you're using language to sort of allude to certain things, but they may not be saying it explicitly. Basically, what ended up happening was they just put on this advisory label that the artists themselves decided with the record studios to put on. It wasn't ever required that they did that.
So artists would talk with labels and they would make the decision of whether or not their piece of work would carry this label. And there was a lot of concern at the time that this might really impact how things sold. Would parents still be willing to buy records for their kids that had this label on them? Would kids be able to access this music? Did it have a commercial impact?
It had a commercial impact in two different ways. I mean, you have big stores like Walmart. They refused to sell albums with explicit labels on them. But, you know, it ended up happening that, like, if anything, then your parents tell you not to touch something, you want it. So so these albums that ended up having explicit lyrics or explicit content advisory labels on them, they became coveted. And for some artists, specifically artists within the rap genre, hip-hop genre, it kind of made their sales better. It's really funny. There's a heavy metal group called... I'm losing the name, but there's a picture of Tipper Gore, and she's holding up, it's called Wasp. She's holding their record, and she's so incensed by it. But at the time, no one really knew who Wasp was. After that picture came out, their record sales went through the roof.
I mean, that's so interesting, because even up to today, I feel like this label has kind of become so iconic, it even pops up on album covers. Like, it's part of Kendrick Lamar's To Pimp a Butterfly, and yeah. I feel like you see it everywhere now, so it's kind of become its own thing.
I mean, it's become sort of a branding of anti-establishment, which, you know, I think is really interesting, considering Tipper Gore wanted to create a conversation more about what we should be allowing our children to be listening to. And what ended up happening was the children decided they wanted to be a bit more anti-establishment than their parents, just like she probably would have been with her parents, because she does constantly say in these hearings that she loves rock and roll music. She just thinks that it's too explicit now. But at, you know, the time that she was listening to it, there were lyrics and songs that also referred to sex quite explicitly.
So in the time that the label was created, they were focusing more on rock music or reaction to rock music. Then there was the popularity of rap music that, you know, maybe took some of them by surprise. And some reporting from the New York Times in the mid-90s, I think, documented that rap records tend to get labeled more often than rock albums that are every bit as explicit. So talk a bit about racial bias and labeling and differences among genres.
Yeah, I mean, I think a portion of that is a decision on the part of the artist and the label to put that label on their albums, because it does lend sort of a bit of credence to an alternative kind of mindset. But at the same time, you know, you have artists like N.W.A. I think it was the first rap album to have have a parental advisory label on it. And, you know, what they were talking about were things like police violence. They were talking about really difficult social issues that I think, you know, the rest of America wasn't really ready to have a conversation about. So instead of listening to these things and thinking about, oh, what is this as a commentary on our society, what they saw as violence, and that was that. You know, if you can write something off as violence, you don't have to have a harder conversation about what that violence actually means, where it's coming from, why people are feeling the need to make music about it.
That's interesting. Do you know how much tension there is between artists and labels about whether or not to consider this work explicit or obscene?
Unfortunately, that is not my expertise. But from what I can tell is, you know, on the NWA album Straight Outta Compton, like, they did have a song that said parental advisory is, or parental guidance is advised. I can't remember the exact phrasing, but, you know, I think there is a component of it that it is a badge of pride.
It's curious to think about sexuality in this context. You mentioned that the concern of Tipper Gore was related to a song that referenced female masturbation. And we come up to today, to 2020. And just a month ago or so, there was a big conversation about Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion's song WAP, about what's too explicit, what is too sexual. And I'd love to hear kind of your take on where we've come in how much we think is okay to talk about when it comes to sex and sexuality, and how much that definition has evolved in the 20 or so years.
I mean, to be honest, the fact that people see WAP and the music video where there are no men, it really is just about two women celebrating their sexuality, celebrating the fact that women have desires, have sexual, you know, relationships, have this thing in them that we all have. You know, it's the same thing as Tipper Gore looking at a reference to female masturbation and being, you know, incensed by it. It's our unwillingness to allow women to be able to have desire without it becoming something that's uncomfortable for us.
And how much of it is about children, do you think, and how much of it is about kind of you know, acceptable standards for what's okay in cultural conversation. I feel like the use of parents and parental advisory is, you know, makes you think that it's a lot about protecting children, but I'm curious how much it actually is.
I mean, that has a much longer history in America. You know, in the 19th century, you have this sort of creation of a precious childhood, and that children are things that need to be protected, and that what comes with that are labor laws. You know, that children can't work in factories anymore, that they need to be raised in a certain way so that they can be moral citizens. And I think that this is sort of an extension of that. It's 100 years later, where you have this worry that our children, if they aren't raised a certain way, if they aren't exposed to the right things, if they're morally corrupted, then you're going to have a morally corrupt society.
And it expands beyond now because we have, I mean, people aren't going into stores and buying CDs anymore. They're streaming music online, but this has bled over into podcasts, for example. So iTunes and Spotify using these same kinds of rating systems for the podcasts that they release. So it's interesting that this method still continues. Do you think it makes sense for mediums like podcasting to use the same kind of content advisory system?
I mean, it's a bit of a weird one because I don't know how useful the advisory labels are to begin with. With podcasts, it's interesting to see that, you know, you have podcasts that get an explicit rating. A lot of the times, it's people who are discussing things like sex and sexuality, or they're actually having the conversation. It's not just a reference, and actually it could be quite useful for people to listen to and understand a bit better. On the one hand, I think I get that people may not want their children to be exposed to things too young, or maybe someone, you know, knows that they're sensitive content and maybe they would prefer not to be exposed to it. But, you know, we live in a society with one another where we do at some point have to acknowledge that there are things we are uncomfortable with. And when you put a label on something that says that it, you know, it needs to be advised, it makes you feel like it's a bad thing or it's something that you shouldn't be engaging with. You know, it sort of creates this moral binary that we are trying, I think the younger generations are trying to sort of upend and sort of create more of a gray area of, actually, if we have more conversations about things that we think are explicit, then maybe they'll become less taboo. Maybe we can actually create more inclusive spaces.
What's interesting about that is the series that we're talking to you right now as part of Embodied is its own podcast now. And we've been having this interesting conversation with iTunes about the rating because one of the episodes does address porn. And they have said that because of that, we have to label the whole podcast explicit, even though many of the other episodes are not referencing that. None of them use explicit language. And so there's it really plays to what you were just talking about, which is it explicit to have a conversation about sexual topics that is not using explicit language and that is more for edification and educational purposes? Or is this actually, you know, content that should be shielded from certain listeners? And the thing about iTunes is it's an international platform. So rating something as explicit can mean that some countries don't get access to that content altogether. So it kind of creates this whole messy ecosystem for a medium that, you know, it's using the same system that it wasn't necessarily intended for.
Yeah, I mean, I've listened to Embodied and it does talk about exactly what you said, is that it's having a conversation about a difficult topic that some people feel uncomfortable about in a way that gives people sort of an empowered stance to be able to discuss these things about themselves later on. It's interesting to me that we would try under any circumstances to restrict difficult conversations. You know, we're living in a time where everyone sort of lives on one end of a spectrum and there's no communication in between because we've decided that the other person is completely wrong or they're bad or they're, you know, they just don't align with our values. And when we create these value structures that exclude, you know, expression, a breadth of expression, then there's never going to be any kind of change from that.
Do you think that our cultural definition of what is explicit or obscene has changed in the past few decades?
I think for some, I think young women are now feeling really empowered, you know, especially because of artists like Cardi B and Megan Thee Stallion, to say that I am a sexual being, I am someone who has desires, this is something I'm able to have ownership of. But at the same time, you still have a very conservative section of the country that really, really wants to sort of tamp down on that and sees that as something really scary.
Would there
you know,
be?
And I think that,
yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No. I'd rather you ask me a question.
Oh yeah, sure. I was going to ask whether there is a better system or is there another metric to think. But I know you've thought, you know, what if we considered power dynamics as a way of thinking about, you know, whether things were too obscene or explicit? Talk to me about that idea.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think when we look at WAP, that is a celebration, right? But if you're looking at something where you have a person in power who is subjugating someone through sex, yeah, I think that should definitely have an advisory label on it. It's not a healthy representation of a relationship. It's not, you know, it's not something that you maybe want your kids or anyone really wants to have to engage with in a way that is really positive. I think at the end of the day, if we're talking about things that are difficult and the outcome is that we're having positive conversations about them or the representation is positive all around, then I don't think that there's any reason for us to deem it explicit, even if maybe the language is explicit itself.
You're living in the UK now. I wonder how you compare how things are handled there as compared to the United States. Does it look quite different or are there similar cultural standards?
There are and there aren't. I mean, you know, there is a show on like normal TV called Naked Attraction where it comes on after 10 p.m., which is when you can show anything on TV. And basically, it's a dating show where the contestants meet each other on their naked bodies. Like, that is something you would never see in the States. But what it is it's a celebration of how many different bodies there are, how we're attracted. And there's, like, little, you know, infographics that tell you about what desire looks like. You know, they've done it in a way where, yes, there's this sort of, like, scandalous aspect of naked people, but at the same time, you're learning more about the breadth of sexuality within your community, which I think is really useful.
It's also now that we're getting so much more of our content not via, you know, listening to the radio or watching cable TV, but we're accessing things through HBO or Hulu or subscription services where anything goes. It kind of changes your personal filter for what you expect when you turn on a given program. Do you think that that has made a difference?
In what way do you mean?
Like that we are exposed to more easily and we're not expecting people to kind of censor content for us.
Yeah. I mean, you can essentially just live in your own content bubble if you want. You know, it's not like we go to the record store anymore and parents have to worry about their kids picking up a CD that they don't want them to. They have to worry about them downloading it in their own home. So I think there's even more of a reason for us to be having these conversations because we have so much access to things that, you know, if you do have a young person who comes into contact with explicit content that they don't know how to handle or they don't know how to ask questions about, I think that's the biggest thing is they'll, without having the conversation to begin with, the young people don't know how to ask questions about things they find uncomfortable or things that they find shocking or things that they've never come in contact with before.
I'd love to close up by just hearing your thoughts on the role of artists and creators in this conversation. Do you think that they should be pushing the boundaries of what is considered explicit and pushing people to kind of change those norms?
Yes and no. I mean, I think they already are, to be honest. And I think that's always been what artists have done. It's always been a bit anti-establishment, trying to push conversations forward. But you know, it does have a marketing aspect to it that I think is really useful to some artists. And I think the biggest thing is that they should be the ones in control of saying whether or not their content is explicit. And if someone has a problem, says maybe that this is explicit, even though you say it isn't, we should be able to listen to them explain why or why not they decided to add that label to it.
Chloe Rose Crabtree is a food and culture historian and the creator of the public research project Sourced. Chloe, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.